Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Endocrinology. This podcast aims to look at paediatric growth patterns and their impact on health in children with achondroplasia. Financial support for this medical educational activity has been provided to Touch IME by an educational grant from BioMarin. In this first section, Dr. Nadia Merchant and Dr. Andrew Dauber respond to questions and provide their expert insights on the physiology of bone growth, the role of FGF, FGFR3, and CMP, MPR2 signaling, and inheritance patterns in achondroplasia.
Hello and welcome. My name is Andrew Dauber, and I'm the Chief of Endocrinology at the Children's National Hospital in Washington, D.C., in the United States of America. I'm here with my colleague, Dr. Nadia Merchant, a pediatric endocrinologist and geneticist here at Children's National as well. She's joining me today for this conversation on pediatric growth patterns and their impact on health, focusing on achondroplasia. Following an overview of bone growth and development, including the underlying pathophysiology of achondroplasia, we'll explore current approaches to recognizing and assessing achondroplasia, including how assessment criteria and growth charts support tailored care provision. Finally, we'll take a look at new and emerging targeted therapies and their potential impact on individualizing clinical management. In our first section, we'll be discussing bone growth, understanding normal and abnormal physiology. We're going to start by focusing on the growth plate. So the growth plate has four different zones, starting with the resting zone, the proliferative zone, the hypertrophic zone, and finally either the calcification or ossification zone where new bone is formed. And we focus on the cell called the chondrocyte, which is the cell responsible for forming new bone in a process called endochondral ossification. In the resting zone lie the stem cells for the chondrocytes, where they'll keep themselves replicating to keep a constant stash of stem cells. They then proceed into the proliferative zone, where more copies are made, the chondrocytes line up in columns to further differentiate into the hypertrophic zone, where they get larger and start making more of the extracellular matrix and the factors needed to form new bone. In a disorder like achondroplasia, there is dysregulated bone formation in all of these various zones. So there's limited chondrocyte production, fewer of the chondrocytes mature and grow in the hypertrophic zone, and this ultimately leads to impaired endochondral ossification and abnormal morphology at the growth plate. There are two key signaling pathways that are involved in normal growth at the growth plate. The first is the FGFR3 receptor and pathway. FGFR3 acts as a brake to growth. It negatively regulates endochondral bone growth and suppresses chondrocyte proliferation and terminal differentiation. Interacting with that FGFR3 pathway is the NPR2 CNP pathway. CNP stands for C-type natriuretic peptide, and it binds to its receptor encoded by the gene NPR2. And that pathway opposes the effects of FGFR3. It lifts the brake, thereby promoting growth at the growth plate. In achondroplasia, there are variants in the FGFR3 gene which cause overactivation and excessive signaling through this pathway, further leading to a break on growth and leading ultimately to short stature and disproportionate growth. There have also been inactivating mutations in the NPR2 gene and in that pathway, which also lead to short stature conditions, including idiopathic short stature, and in its recessive form to a skeletal dysplasia called acromesomelic dysplasia, marotoid type. Now, in individuals who have activating variants in the FGFR3 gene, there's a spectrum of short stature conditions. The mildest is called hypochondroplasia. More significant mutations in that same gene lead to achondroplasia, which is what we'll be discussing today. And even more severe variants can lead to a severe form of a skeletal dysplasia called thanatophoric dysplasia, which can often be lethal in infancy or as an embryo, although sometimes children can survive with significant medical comorbidities. Now, Dr. Merchant, let's look at some questions submitted by our audience regarding bone growth and development in people with achondroplasia. So for our first question, what are the preferred terms to use for people with skeletal dysplasia, and in particular, achondroplasia?
So when we think about achondroplasia, we think about little people, and that is a well-accepted term to be using. Whenever we're talking to a patient or a person with achondroplasia, you want to refer to others with average height and not normal height. So that's important to be able to be aware of that when you're talking to them. Also, we don't like to use the word achon or achondroplasia patient. Instead, we want to say patient with achondroplasia. And that's just in general with anything we use. We want to describe the person as a person and by their name, and then say with whatever condition skeletal dysplasia they have. So you would say John with achondroplasia. And so also you don't want to be using the word M word, midget. That's definitely not to be used. Dwarf is a term that's accepted by some and not by others. So I would be a little bit more careful about using that term specifically.
And do you have advice, perhaps, should we ask the patients what their preferred terms is? How do you typically approach that?
I do. I like to specifically ask them what they like to be called by, and also whether they want to be, well, if you can use their name, you want to use their name when you're talking, interacting with them. But also just when we're presenting in general, I think we should always say the patient with achondroplasia and not describe them as the condition itself.
Excellent. Thank you for that. All right, now we're going to turn to our second question. So why is it important to understand the role of the FGF, FGFR3, and that CNP-NPR2 signaling in achondroplasia? Are there other molecular features that we should be considering?
So when we're talking about skeletal dysplasias in general, you want to be able to differentiate the chondrodysplasias and osteodysplasia. So is it affecting the growth plate specifically? And so when we think about the different skeletal dysplasias that are affecting in the growth plate, knowing before clinically we would diagnose the patients, we would diagnose them clinically and by X-ray findings. And now we know specifically what gene is affecting them and how that affects the pathway and exactly what's happening at the growth plate to affect their growth. So it's important now that because we understand the genes affecting them, we also can think about treatments in a sense, in the future, of where in the pathway can we treat and what will work and what would not work. So in achondroplasia specifically, it's FGFR3 that's affected, and that causes the negative regulation as you're talking about, and that decreases their growth. Now in the past, even in FGFR3, it depends on where the variant is and what type, the presentation clinically can be very different. So there is one specific hotspot for achondroplasia, and you only see the variant at that specific spot versus hypochondroplasia, orthoanatrophic dysplasia, those are a lot more severe and the change is different on the FGFR3. So now that we understand the specific gene variant, we can also have a better understanding of what's the specific presentation that we see.
Gotcha. And I've heard you say in the past that not all individuals with a skeletal dysplasia have achondroplasia. So can genetic testing help clarify that?
Yes. And so generally, most people, when they think of little people, they think of achondroplasia because it is the most common. But there are lots of genetic skeletal dysplasias out there. And it's over the years, we've understand more and more about them. And so, yes, we definitely need to know what's the difference. The one thing about achondroplasia, it's very easy to recognize. There are certain findings that you will see in these patients that makes it very, like, you know, this is achondroplasia. And the other skeletal dysplasias have different findings.
Got it. Excellent. We're going to turn to our next question. What do we understand about the inheritance pattern of achondroplasia, and what are the clinical implications of that?
So achondroplasia is autosomal dominant. A lot of the other skeletal dysplasias are autosomal recessive. So it's autosomal dominant means it's inherited by one mutation you get from one parent. And 80% of the children born with achondroplasia have an average height parents. Their 20% come from a parent who has achondroplasia. Now, if you have two parents with achondroplasia, they have a 50% risk of having a child with achondroplasia, one either from the mom's gene or the dad's. But if they have the get both mutations from both the parents, then that is a much more severe, almost lethal skeletal dysplasia. And then the other 25%, they don't have achondroplasia. So it's important to understand the genetics of it, because you will be counseling families. What's the risk? If they have another child, what's the risk for them having another child with achondroplasia?
Excellent. So thank you for those insights. I think we really have a good understanding now of the molecular basis of achondroplasia and how that's going to help guide our diagnosis and therapy. And we're going to move on to our next section.
In this second section, Dr. Nadia Merchant and Dr. Andrew Dauber respond to questions on detecting and assessing achondroplasia and provide their expert insights on the tools used to assess and monitor development, the role of growth charts, and monitoring for the medical complications of achondroplasia at different ages.
In our second section, we're now going to be discussing detecting and assessing achondroplasia to tailor care, the importance of growth charts, and a specific assessment criteria. In 2022, there was recently published the International Achondroplasia Consensus Statement. This was a group of international experts from all different specialties who came together to discuss the standards of care for individuals with achondroplasia. And they highlight some important points about using clinical and radiographic hallmarks to make accurate diagnoses in most cases. But genetic testing can be used to provide confirmation when clinical signs are limited. As Dr. Merchant told us earlier, there's a specific genetic variant, the GLI380 arginine variant, which is present in 99% of cases of individuals with achondroplasia. The guidelines also assess the importance of regular monitoring of growth and development. It talks a bit about the difference in developmental milestones, which we'll explore with Dr. Merchant, and the importance of investigating delays in milestone attainment, as well as the multi-system manifestations that can occur in achondroplasia. There's also been growth charts developed specifically for individuals with achondroplasia. And in addition to just measuring the height and the weight as we would typically in any child, the CDC and WHO also recommend additional anthropometric measurements such as head circumference, segmental length, sitting height, and so on. And the International Consensus Guideline highlight the need to provide the parents with specific growth charts so that they can see how their child is growing compared to other children with achondroplasia, and the need to monitor growth longitudinally to help identify if there are any deviations from the expected growth pattern for a child with achondroplasia. Now, Dr. Merchant, let's look at some questions submitted by our audience on how we assess and monitor achondroplasia, including the role of those growth charts. So our first question asks, how does dysregulated bone growth impact development in people living with achondroplasia? And what tools do you use to assess and monitor development in these children?
So first off, how tall are children or adults with achondroplasia? They're about 4'1" to 4'5". That's where we're at most commonly. So it's important to use the growth charts that we have available for achondroplasia to see where they are growing in that growth chart. And because if we use a regular growth chart, you may not find the subtle differences. For clinically monitoring them, now, because of their difference in they have smaller arms and legs compared to their trunk, but they also have other findings that can lead to other complications. So it's really important that we monitor them accordingly. So at birth into the first year of life, it's really important that we get a sleep study once they're diagnosed to make sure that they don't have sleep apnea, because there are reported cases of sudden infant death syndrome. And we know now it's because of the foramen magnum stenosis that can occur. And also they can have sometimes neurological findings so a regular neuro exam is very important, mm-hmm. because if you have changes in the reflexes or the tone, that can give you subtle findings that there may be something going on. Head circumference is really important to monitor, because if your head circumference increases, then you are thinking of hydrocephalus, which can also be due to the way their spine is. And so you have increased amount of fluid in the spinal fluid. And they have headaches and other findings, but it's always sometimes hard to assess in a one-year-old. The other thing that we want to be thinking about is the findings as they get older. So into adulthood, you have spinal stenosis that can occur, and that can cause some neurological findings too, where they may complain of clonus, they may complain of like tingling that's there, and that can also make you assess for spinal stenosis and do an imaging to determine if something needs to be done. Sometimes you may do something more surgical, or sometimes other things that may be indicated.
Got it. And I know there are these guidelines, but do you have specific recommendations or references of how frequently should the children be monitored? And is there some reference that can help guide pediatricians or pediatric endocrinologists in how to care for these children?
So the AAP recently updated their 1995 health supervision guidelines in 2020, and it has specific recommendations of what should be done at each age interval, starting prenatally, pre-pregnancy, all the way into adulthood, and it recommends what to do, when, what to do. So those are really good reference for those taking care of children, and even for parents with kids with achondroplasia and adults.
That's great. That's very helpful. And maybe you could give us a clue, just one example. I know, as you mentioned, the body proportions, the head circumference is different. How would that affect the developmental milestone for infants with achondroplasia?
So there's also some guidelines on what milestones we should expect. So we shouldn't be comparing the normal milestones that we see in a child that's with achondroplasia. They have relative macrocephaly compared to their body habitus. So they have a harder time sitting up, having their head sit up. And so some of their milestones are different. They may wind up crawling and rolling over before they're able to sit without support. And so it's really important that we follow these milestones and compare them to children with achondroplasia based on what we know. And there are several different references we can look at to show what miles to expect. And the Denver milestones that we use as pediatricians, we can follow along and shouldn't really be confused that this is something we need to be working up for the child versus can we say this is normal. But if sometimes they're not meeting a certain milestone that we expect with achondroplasia, we do want to make sure we appropriately assess them. They may need a brain MRI to make sure that there isn't foramen magnum stenosis.
Excellent. That's great insight. For our next question, what role do the growth charts play in the assessment, monitoring, and management of achondroplasia?
It is really important to use the growth charts that we have available for achondroplasia because we want to make sure they're growing appropriately. Just like any other child, they can be diagnosed with thyroid disease or any other condition, celiac, that may affect their growth. And so we want to make sure they're appropriately growing on the growth chart for achondroplasia for height perspective. Now, weight is also really important. We want to make sure they're living a healthy lifestyle and making sure that because we do know that there's a higher risk of them developing obesity. So that is something we should be able to start talking about and working with them from earlier on. So it is really important to use those growth charts in reference.
Excellent. And what are the medical complications of achondroplasia at different ages, and how do you monitor for them? And do particular treatments affect the complications we see? I know you've mentioned some of these, but if you want to just lay out for us kind of an overview through the timeline of how you think about these.
So if we start at birth to like the first few years of life, the most biggest concern is foramen magnum stenosis, mm-hmm. which can lead to sleep apnea, sudden infant death. And they also, that's one. The other is recurrent ear infections. So they may need adenoidectomy because of sleep apnea also, and recurrent ear infections. So that is another one we tend to follow really closely in the first few years of life. And then as they get older, we're following their genuvera that they have, the bowing, because that can also affect the way they walk, but also can sometimes lead to limb length discrepancies. And so that is really important because that can affect pain later on if that continues, if we do not address it. And then as they get into adulthood, the spinal stenosis can be a major issue. And it's always better to intervene sooner than later. Sometimes they have to do laminectomy, sometimes they have to do decompression. And so to be able to avoid the complications and especially the pain that they develop with that later on. So there are different clinically monitoring that we do based on the age to be able to give a better lifestyle later on, because the life expectancy for achondroplasia is just like normal as in anybody else. So we want to make sure we give them the best quality of life. And that is, if we do this monitoring, that improves their life, quality of life, especially pain.
Gotcha. And I understand that in infancy, there's often some lordosis of the lumbar spine, but that can resolve over time, or that can improve?
Yes. So the lordosis that exists, the kyphosis that they have, it tends to improve as they start walking. Mm. And so that is something we do see that generally improves. You want to make sure you're seeing an expert orthopedic surgeon for that, because you don't want to be doing interventions unnecessarily for these children, because that can lead to them having less mobility, which can make things more complicated for them. So, but they do have kyphosis, and so that is something we monitor very carefully.
Excellent. So Dr. Merchant, I know we're going to speak in more detail about treatments in the next section, but with these various complications that you were just reviewing, are there particular treatments that are going to affect the occurrence of those complications?
So yes. So first, like if you're having spinal stenosis, the earlier you intervene, the less complications you're going to have. So that's important to catch early. Also, the foramen magnum stenosis, if we need to do anything, it needs to be done earlier than later to avoid sudden death. And then also there are like limb length surgeries, and which we'll talk about, that there are complications associated with that. And then there also is improvement in height. So, and those are done for different reasons, sometimes for limb length discrepancy versus for just more of a height or being able to reach certain places. If your arms are not long enough, you may not be able to do self-care. And so by lengthening the arms, it may make it easier to do self-care for yourself.
Excellent. Well, thank you for those insights. I think we really have a good understanding now of the developmental trajectory of individuals with achondroplasia and really the important need to use specific growth charts as well as developmental evaluations. And you pointed us to some guidelines of how to do adequate and appropriate monitoring for these children. So thank you for that.
In this final section, Dr. Nadia Merchant and Dr. Andrew Dauber respond to questions on the clinical management of achondroplasia and provide their expert insights on the role of pharmacotherapy in the management of achondroplasia, the future feasibility of gene therapy, surgical interventions, and the roadmap for optimal management of the condition.
In our third section, we'll be discussing individualizing clinical management in achondroplasia and the potential role for emerging targeted therapies. One key point is that multidisciplinary management is extremely important in achondroplasia. There are multiple different specialists that are required to properly care for children and adults with achondroplasia, including ENT specialists, genetic counseling, neurologists, nutrition, physical therapy, and respiratory and sleep medicine, as well as, of course, orthopedics. There's now the potential for pharmacotherapies that are targeting the specific pathophysiology with hopes of avoiding medical complications. There are surgical options both to treat medical comorbidities as well as potentially for limb lengthening and height augmentation. And finally, it's really important to focus on the whole health needs of the patient and their family, making sure that they have adequate psychosocial support and family support groups, as well as always focusing on individual pain management. So there are a number of medications that are currently either in development or recently approved for targeting the achondroplasia pathophysiology. As we know, the main source of the aberrant signaling is the activation at the FGFR3 receptor. And there have been a number of different approaches to try and improve that signaling. One approach is to bind the various FGFs, the growth factors that bind to that receptor, by using a decoy receptor that could suck it up. Another is to have antibodies to the receptor, or to have an inhibitor of the tyrosine kinase domain of the receptor itself. A different approach is to use that CNP pathway that we've been talking about so much by making analogs of CNP and increasing signaling through that CNP-NPR2 pathway, thereby blocking the downstream signaling of the FGFR3 receptor. And the only medication that is approved in the US and Europe for the treatment of achondroplasia is called vosoritide, and that is an analog of CNP. In Japan, growth hormone is used, as growth hormone affects not this pathway directly, but also promotes proliferation and differentiation of the chondrocytes. And finally, there's another medication called meclizine, which is being investigated, that also targets the downstream signaling pathway from FGFR3. Now, Dr. Merchant, let's look at some questions submitted by our audience on how we can individualize management in achondroplasia, including the potential role of these new targeted therapies. So for our first question, what do you think is the role for pharmacotherapy in the management of achondroplasia? Are they being routinely used?
So the role of pharmacotherapy is really, can we work exactly at the growth plate to help growth? And also the complications that happen due to the way the growth plates are functioning. At this time, growth hormone, as you mentioned, is being used in Japan, but we've only seen that it helps in the first year or two of life to maybe first year or two of using the drug, and only by a few centimeters. Recently, vosoritide, a CNP analog, was approved starting at the age of 2 in Europe and at the age of 5 in the US. And that has only been there in clinical trials right now, and now we've started to use it. So we know it improves the growth velocity by about 1.6 centimeters a year, but we don't know whether it'll have any changes on the complications that these patients have to deal with. And that is going to be really exciting to see whether it does help or not. And then there's a lot of other drugs, as we mentioned, that are currently being studied in clinical trials to see if it will help with growth, but also the medical complications.
You know, as you mentioned, currently, vosoritide in the U.S. only approved for ages 5 and up based on the phase 3 trial that you alluded to. What was just recently presented at the Endocrine Society meeting is results of a phase 2 study in children below the age of 5 years. And what they did see was that compared to the individuals who received placebo, the height Z-score did improve by 0.3 standard deviation, and the growth velocity improved by just under 1 centimeter, or around 0.9 centimeters per year. There was not yet a change in body segments in the body disproportion, although that took a few years in the older children to be able to see that difference. The safety profile overall was quite good, with no new safety signals. As you mentioned, there are ongoing studies to see whether this will prevent the complications, and we really don't know that answer yet.
Well, I think to add to that, vosoritide has been pretty safe in general to use. Like, it does cause a little bit of a low blood pressure for some and the site injection sites, but there hasn't been any major complications that we've seen with the drug itself.
Mm-hmm. And do you see that most patients are moving towards one of these new pharmacotherapies, or is this not yet routinely accepted for use?
I think that it depends on who the person is and how much the family wants to use the drug. Sometimes families feel that it's not enough of a growth improvement, that they would want to give an injection every day to their child. And for some parents, that is significant to them. I think really time will tell us. And I think the biggest thing is, will it change the way they have clinical complications? And that's really what's exciting to see what's going to happen. And I feel with any rare disease drug, it's important that we do these trials to see if it does improve, because we're not going to get the numbers fast enough. So it only time will tell us.
Well, Dr. Merchant, we just spoke a little bit about the medications that have been approved for a treatment of achondroplasia. Can you tell us a little bit more about what medications are currently under investigation?
So as you had mentioned earlier, there is other ones that specifically work at the FGF, like ligand, the decoys, to kind of decrease the activity. And then there is also like meclizine that's being studied, which is approved drug, but not specifically for achondroplasia. And then there is the anti-FGFR3 that it can exist. And also there's a TransCon CNP that's currently, I believe, in phase 2, and that is a longer acting CNP, so you would have to give it less frequently.
Gotcha. So there's that decoy receptor, I think Recipricept, the targeting the FGFR3 at the tyrosine kinase, there's infigratinib, the antibodies, vafatimab, and then, of course, meclizine, and then the long-acting version of CMP, the transcon CMP. Yeah. That's a lot of drugs
in
development.
I mean, just understanding the basic growth plate genetics has made all of this possible. And that's why the genetic diagnosis of certain conditions is so helpful.
Yeah, and I'm sure we're all really looking forward to seeing those clinical trial results.
Yes.
For our next question, what are your thoughts on gene therapy for people with achondroplasia? Is that in the works?
Theoretically, gene therapy may be able to be done. I don't know of any studies being done on gene therapy at this time. And we'd have to target really specifically at the growth plate, and FGFR3 is available at other places too, the receptor itself. And that's a little bit more challenging. Is it likelihood? Yes, but are there going to be complications to it? I don't know. So at this point, I don't know if there's anything for gene therapy going on. I think the clinical kind of pharmacotherapy is a lot more exciting to me.
So I think that's an important message for our audience and people out there that while gene therapy may be an idea for the future, that's not something that's going to be coming in the next few years or likely even decade for individuals with achondroplasia. So the focus has really been on pharmacotherapies.
Agree.
So Dr. Merchant, for our next question, can you tell us about the types of surgeries that are commonly performed in individuals with achondroplasia? And do the benefits outweigh the risks?
So there are medically necessary procedures that we talked about that can avoid life-threatening complications. So if you have sleep apnea, if you have foramen magnum stenosis, you have needing ear tubes, if you have recurrent ear infections, those are medically necessary procedures. And then there are elective surgeries that can sometimes be medically necessary too, but such as limb lengthening. So limb lengthening is done for just increasing the height, and it can be done in all the extremities, or sometimes because of limb length discrepancy where one leg is longer than the other, then they will do it only on the one extremity, so that way it's easier to walk. And then some will decide to do it for more self-care. They'll just do the upper extremities and not the lower because they want to be able to reach places like self-care for those reasons. And so those are things. Those are surgeries that we think about. Some are medically necessary, some are more elective. And if we're doing elective limb lengthening, you want to make sure it's a group discussion with the child and the family, since it does affect their mobility and activities. This is a longer like surgery, and then there are complications of surgery itself. The other thing to consider is anesthesia risk, right? So first, if you're going to go through sedation, you want to make sure it is safe, that you know that the anesthesiologist who's doing it knows how to do this anesthesia, and also make sure there's no like adenoids that are enlarged or anything that can cause complications from that standpoint.
Excellent, very helpful, thank you. Is there a roadmap for optimal management and care in achondroplasia? And if so, what does that currently look like?
We have to do it as a multidisciplinary approach. There needs to be the pediatrician involved. There needs to be a geneticist involved who makes the diagnosis. And orthopedics and ENT are key players. There are other subspecialties that also play part of the team, but those are the main primary ones. I think now endocrine is going to be one of the big players, especially if we're doing pharmacotherapy, following them on growth, along with puberty and all of those factors. But though we need to be talking all together to make sure we're not missing any complication. So the best way is having a multidisciplinary approach where everybody is communicating, making sure that the appropriate screenings are being done, and not just a treatment, since we've been talking about treatment. But we want to make sure we're giving them a holistic approach, have therapists if they need to be involved, like occupational therapy, physical therapy, psychology involved, because we do want to maximize the child's potential into adulthood. They live a normal life expectancy, and they also are intellectually normal. We want to make sure they can get around. And do they get their pedal extensions for driving a car at the age of 16? Or those are things that we all need to be considering and thinking about when we're taking care of them. So they're giving a holistic approach.
Excellent. That was really helpful. Thank you, Dr. Merchant, for taking us through the various therapies and how they impact the lifestyle and life course of these children. Well, Dr. Merchant, I just really want to thank you for this really fascinating conversation today and thank our audience for listening. We've reviewed a wide range of topics, but first learning about the mechanisms behind various bone growth control systems, focusing on FGFR3 and NPR2, and now how that leads to the pathophysiology of achondroplasia. We learned a lot about the importance of using specific growth charts for children with achondroplasia and monitoring developmental milestones appropriately, as well as the importance of routine healthcare supervision for monitoring for the complications throughout the lifespan. And finally, you gave us some great insights into novel and emerging therapies and the current standard of care for treatment for achondroplasia and how this is going to change in the future. So thank you again. We hope that the audience has enjoyed and found this quite educational.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic on Touch Endocrinology at www.touchendocrinology.com.